From WBUR in Boston, it's Weekly Warm-Up, a sampling of the cornucopia of stories and interviews featured on Only a Game, sports public radio style.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment at visasignature.com.
Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Amid the sound and fury occasioned by former radio host Don Imus's witless and cruel characterization of the members of the Rutgers women's basketball team on April 4th, one response seems to me exceptional for the wisdom and charity it reflects. At a press conference on Tuesday, Kia Vaughn, a member of the Rutgers team, spoke of the team's intention to meet with Mr. Imus and said, "I'd like for him to get to know us." Since then, Imus has been fired by CBS, in part because he described those young women he didn't know and had probably never seen play basketball as nappy-headed hoes, and in part because most of the companies that had sponsored his radio program decided to stop doing so. Meeting with Kia Vaughn, Essence Carson, and the rest of the members of the Rutgers team on Thursday night may or may not have changed Don Imus. Ratings long ago taught him that in our culture there is a place for insults and slurs, no matter how moronic they may be. That's a hard truth to repudiate when you've been making a lot of money embracing it. But if it occurs to some of the many people who've been paying attention to this controversy that Kia Vaughn is right and that nobody who knew her and her teammates would have made the remarks Don Imus made, some benefit may come from this otherwise irredeemable tale of ignorance and woe. It's not surprising that Coach C. Vivian Stringer, who may know the Rutgers players better than anyone except their families, talked at length about their accomplishments and the sterling qualities of the potential doctor, lawyer, and psychologist presently wearing the Rutgers colors. But by the time they've written their next term papers and run their next laps, it's likely to occur to the Rutgers players that despite the protestations of one of their number, they haven't really been scarred for life. They are already far too accomplished and self-confident to be seriously damaged by the stupid remarks of an uninformed man so irrelevant to their lives that most of them had never heard of him before last week. That's not to underestimate the idiocy of Imus and his crew, but only to suggest that the players who were the targets of their insults will be thriving long after Imus has been forgotten. At 9:35 on Monday morning, weather allowing, the 111th running of the Boston Marathon will commence when the wheelchair division breaks the starting line in Hopkinton, Massachusetts. Even when there isn't rain, wind, or even snow, marathoning is not an easy sport, and for the last 2.5 decades, it's been unusually difficult for U.S. runners. It's been 24 years since an American has won the open division of the Boston Marathon, but on Monday, an American woman has a chance to break that drought. Only a Game's Karen Given has the story.
Marathoner Dina Castor says the U.S. Olympic Training Center in Chula Vista is the perfect place to get away from everyday life and focus on training. It's calm, quiet, and surrounded by recent subdivisions built into the hills, pre-planned to offer brand new gravel running trails built right in. Today, Coach Terrence Mahen will be leading Dina Castor and Team Running USA on what he describes as a recreational run. But while we're chatting, he's leaning against a bike borrowed for the occasion from Olympic pole vault gold medalist Stacy Dragila. While Mahen and his athletes are on a recreational run, I'm going to need an Olympian's bike to keep up.
Yeah, you know, these guys will go out and run somewhere 6-minute pace per mile, you know, maybe a little bit slower. But, for the general public, it's not so easy.
Dina Castor has already won the Chicago and London marathons and taken bronze at the Olympics in Athens. Now she's trying to become the first American woman to win Boston since Joan Benoit Samuelson. And her coach, at least, thinks she has a shot.
There's a high hope from a lot of people, you know. Number one from Dina, she's looking to, obviously, win Boston Marathon is the number one goal. Boston being, you know, the big race out there, you know, over 100 years old, it's an epic race to try to win. And so that's been the goal for, you know, the past 6 months.
The success of Dina Castor and her teammate Meb Keflezighi, who won silver in the Olympics in Athens, came as a surprise. Some would even say a shock. Since the mid-1980s, with the exception of Chicago, Americans have not won any other major marathon, Boston, London, Berlin, or New York. So what's changed?
You know, I think a lot of things have changed. In the beginning was, you know, we were at such a low in U.S. distance running in 2000. We sent one male marathoner, one female marathoner to the Olympics when we could have sent three, but we didn't have three people good enough to hit the qualifying standards. And I think that was just such a major shock to everyone in the American distance running world. It was like, so everyone put their thinking caps on and said, what do we have to do to get this going again?
Those thinking caps resulted in the USA Distance Project, an initiative to get Americans back on the winner's podium at major marathon events. It's a fundraising effort, of course, but also a change in the way American marathoners train. Instead of the lone runner hitting the pavement for 150 miles or so a week, distance runners are now being encouraged to train in groups. It's an idea that was borrowed from the Kenyans and Ethiopians, the dominant distance runners of today, and also from the American runners in the 70s and 80s, when Mahen says American marathoning was at its peak.
And out of those groups, we had the Frank Shorters, the Bill Rogers, the Joan Samuelsons, the Alberto Salazars, who were the big icons and big players in the world. And then the group seemed to just fade out, whether it was financial reasons or what. And then, you know, in hand, American distance running faded out.
The loss of America's running teams not only made it harder for distance runners to train and get access to great coaching, it also became harder for athletes to find sponsorship. Jill Geer of USA Track and Field says the Distance Project and its focus on team training aimed to change that.
It's easier for a team to attract financial sponsors than it is for one individual. And it also helps to spread the money around as well. So if you have a team with one or two great athletes, you can really market that team to corporate America and draw in money that will then support those up-and-coming runners, because it's the up-and-comers who end up making the difference 4, 5, 6 years from now.
No one expected the Distance Project to show results right away. That's because it takes 8, 9, even 10 years for distance runners to really hit their stride.
An example of that is actually the Hanson's Brooks Distance Project, which has been part of the USA Distance Project, and they had 6 guys in the top 20 at Boston last year, which was incredible. Now, they started out as sort of a national club of decent national athletes, but over the years, they've developed into an elite club, and they've also seen their sponsorship increase over the years. Now, that's probably not an accident. You know, money helps athletes be able to devote the time they need to train.
Traditionally, most of a runner's income comes from the shoe companies, and that's not likely to change. But the USA Distance Project aims to widen those sponsorship opportunities to include everything from car dealerships to local banks. And the seed money to start the USA Distance Project came from the marathon organizations themselves, like the New York Roadrunners and their president, Mary Wittenberg.
I think it's the toughest sport in the world. Running marathons and distance running, there's no timeouts, there's no breaks in the action, and you've got to run, you know, upward of 150 miles a week to be able to even step to the line with a chance at winning. So we needed to promote our athletes, we need to give more prize money opportunities, we need to give more appearance money, we need to generate more buzz about them.
The New York Roadrunners bootstrapped the USA Distance Project by pledging $1 for every entrant in the New York City Marathon. In recent years, the club's support has increased tenfold, and Wittenberg says she's still looking for new revenue sources to increase funding even further. But it's not all about money. Wittenberg says in 2000 and 2001, when it was all doom and gloom for American distance runners on the international stage, high schoolers like Alan Webb and Ryan Hall were breaking records and proving that Americans had the potential to be international players.
We saw the seeds had been planted, but they needed nurturing. And I think for a couple decades there, as a sport, we weren't nurturing our athletes after high school and college, and we weren't helping them. We were not at all paving the way to a sport that provided the glory and the incentive to stay in our sport.
Ironically, in the 1990s, while Americans were experiencing a drought on the winner's podium, more and more recreational runners were signing up to run marathons and other distance events. The New York City Marathon uses a lottery system to keep the entrants at a reasonable number, and many of the club's other events are filled beyond capacity as well. So what's in it for the New York Roadrunners to raise money for American athletes? Wittenberg admits that an American champion won't help her fit more people on the starting line of the New York City Marathon, but it will help with some of the club's more lofty goals.
Well, I'm a big believer in American stars. That's what's going to help us get kids running. It certainly helps even adults of all ages and abilities get moving. I mean, look what Tiger Woods has done for golf. And the more that people are paying attention to the big deal event, and the more people recognize that, the more it's going to help them get moving and aspire to be fitter and healthier themselves.
Really?
I'd make fun of you.
Yeah, you made fun of me.
I made fun of Andrew for saying that.
It's 2.5 weeks before the Boston Marathon when I joined Dina Castor and seven other members of Team Running USA for their morning recreational run. Terrence Mahen says these easy runs are necessary for his athletes to recover from hard training days and rediscover their love of running. They also look like a lot of fun. The team chats about everything from the difference between a moth and a butterfly to last night's American Idol. They also run fast, very, very fast. I can follow on the flats, but once Dina Castor and Team Running USA hit the hill trails, I can't even match their pace on a bicycle, and they leave me in the dust. Later, in a sunny room at the Olympic Training Center cafeteria, I meet up again with Dina Castor. While in Chula Vista, the team spends hours a day in this room, chatting and laughing while they eat and recover from workouts. Castor knows that her team provides quite a contrast from the stereotypical solo American marathoner, pounding out mile after lonely mile on the pavement.
Yeah, with pain and struggle, and I guess it gets instilled in physical education at a very early age. But I remember in school that running was always a punishment, that if you didn't dress right for PE, you had to go run 2 laps, a half mile around the soccer field. And I think now people are realizing, as 100,000 people try to join major marathons in the United States and around the world, when that many people are trying to get on the starting line of a race, I think they've pretty much gotten that running is a celebration.
Lots of things make Dina Castor smile. She giggles when her husband steals her chocolate chip cookie at lunch. She beams at the thought of becoming the first American woman to win the Boston Marathon since 1983. But her biggest smile comes when she considers the future of her sport.
It's only the beginning. It's only the tip of the iceberg on what we're going to see in the future when this momentum continues. Distance running is something everybody can relate to, and I think because of that, we're going to see a huge resurgence, not just in performances, but in the fan base as well.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Chula Vista, California.
Letters, we get letters, and sometimes it's because mistakes, I make mistakes. In last week's conversation with Charlie Pierce, I brought up Suni Williams, the astronaut who will be running on a treadmill at the same time the Boston Marathon is being contested on Monday. I said Ms. Williams would be 238,000 miles from Boston at the time, but that would be impossible unless she was going to be on the moon. In fact, she will be on the International Space Station, which is only 225 miles above the Earth. Only. Thanks to Adina Schutzberg, a WBUR listener, and Ed Bride, who hears Only a Game on WAMC in Albany. They were among the listeners who corrected me. Don Dobris, who hears the program on WCPN in Cleveland, caught another mistake when I referred to J.D. Quinn as a former member of the Ohio State football team. It was the Oklahoma team that kicked Mr. Quinn out for taking money from a team booster. Mr. Quinn now plays his football for Montana, not to be confused with Michigan, at least by me. Okay, Bill Littlefield, that's how an email from Alex McDonald of Lincoln, Vermont began. I feared things would not go well after that opening, and they didn't. What is the reason for the lack of coverage of the Frozen Four on this Saturday's broadcast, he wrote. Mr. McDonald was referring to the men's college ice hockey championships. As journalists, you passed up some good stories by ignoring this competition, he said, and he is no doubt right. We cannot be everywhere at once, which was also my reply to Sunil Sika, a WBUR listener whom we dismayed by not revisiting the Cricket World Cup, which, by the way, was won by Australia. And finally, we had an email from Pat Little, another WAMC listener, who came across a description of ice hockey written by a high school student from Madagascar who is spending the winter with a family in Maine. Crazy people run with knives on feet, make combat with tree arms, the young man wrote, and then it poetic. Send your comments, poetic or otherwise, to Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can reach us through the website, onlyagame.org, or leave a message on the listener line at 617-353-1860. If you want to know which NASCAR driver has the best setup or who is the top-ranked fencer, male or female, you need to go no further than Charlie Pierce, but he knows so much more about sports than that, and we're about to learn. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
On Thursday, longtime CBS radio host Don Imus was fired for insulting comments that he made about the black members of the Rutgers women's basketball team. Are you surprised that the firing came as swiftly as it did?
No, I think that this was a camel carrying a great many straws. I think there's a lot of soul searching to be done by a lot of influential people in my business and in the political business as to why they enabled this pathetic 70-year-old bad boy for as long as they did. He finally did something to some victims that the society in general wouldn't tolerate. And even though there's kind of a loathsome backlash going on now against Vivian Stringer and this team about them being, quote unquote, used for X, Y, and Z. And what about rap music? And what about the Duke case? And blah, 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 blah. The fact remains, any professional communicator who said anything like this on a national microphone should be fired. And who I really admire through all this are the NBC News employees who apparently said, hold enough, and went to their bosses and said, him or us.
Right. And this was well before he was fired, actually. Imus met with the coaches, players, and parents of the players on Thursday night. This was after he'd lost his job. Coach C. Vivian Stringer of Rutgers made comments indicating that she felt Imus, quote, stole their dreams, and one player said she was scarred for life as a result of his comments. This may be a bit of hyperbole.
I think they may feel this way now. I don't think they'll feel this way in a year. I don't think the player will feel her life has been scarred when she's 30 years old and telling her children about this great season they had.
And practicing medicine somewhere.
Or playing the piano or whatever.
Exactly.
I think it's probably hyperbole, but I think what was done to them gives them a right to a few days of hyperbole before this fades away.
This week, many cited the current controversy over Imus as proof that no progress has been made in this country regarding attitudes towards race and gender. But given that he's now off the air and that major companies like General Motors, Nextel, Sprint, American Express, Staples, I could go on, distanced themselves from Imus before he was fired, maybe a case can be made that there has been progress.
Well, I mean, let's see. I mean, for all the bloviating about rap music, and why can they say this and we can't and blah, 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 which is a variation on an old and very stupid argument. Let's see if it has any effect on the sponsors of people like Rush Limbaugh and Michael Savage and Glenn Beck, who has his own national television show. Let's go see if the political dialogue gets cleaned up in this country. Why you're seeing all this dust thrown up about rap music is because people don't want to concentrate on the kind of polite obscenity that white talk show hosts, particularly white conservative talk show hosts in this country, have been trafficking in for 15 years.
Charlie, Adam Pac-Man Jones, against whom Las Vegas police have recommended felony and misdemeanor charges stemming from a fight and a shooting in Las Vegas last February, has been suspended for the entire 2007 National Football League season. Is this an indication that the new boss of the NFL is not the same as the old boss?
Yeah, Mr. Goodell is putting down the law. The completely useless NFL Players Association is going along with it. Everyone's cheering. Everyone's having a happy, good time. And every football player in the National Football League's immediate career is now in the hands of any cowboy cop who wants to bust them outside a nightclub or while they're driving their car home from practice. This is going to be a masterpiece of unintended consequences down the road.
The NFL's new conduct policy, which was released on Tuesday, moments after Jones and Cincinnati Bengals wide receiver Chris Henry were suspended, will apparently apply to all NFL employees. Do you think it'll be enforced evenly among all NFL employees?
Oh, absolutely. I'm sure that Mr. Goodell will step right up and take an owner's team away from him if the owner is convicted of pension fraud or something in his outside business. I'm also sure that donkeys are flying outside my window right now.
More than a year after three Duke University lacrosse players were accused of sexual assault, all charges have been dropped. Durham County District Attorney Mike Nifong has apologized to the players for his incorrect judgment, which is quite a phrase. On Thursday, the New York Post published a front-page photo of the accuser in the Duke case, along with the headline, "The Duke Liar, Now America Can See Her Face." Has justice been served for anybody involved in this case?
Well, I think justice is going to be served on Prosecutor Nifong, but I wouldn't sit here and let's congratulate ourselves. Reed Seligman, one of the players, mentioned in the press conference that the scales had fallen from his eyes, and he saw how little the country respects the notion of innocent until proven guilty and the various legal protections that were written into the Constitution to avoid this very, keep this very thing from happening. Really? Congratulations, son. Welcome to the United States of America in 2007. 13 people who were convicted, not merely accused, but convicted of crimes walked out of a prison in Texas because the DA down there had phonied up DNA results last week. If you're concerned about due process and the right of someone to be considered innocent until they're proven guilty, where do we put Guantanamo? Where do we put... This is what we encourage. We cheer prosecutors who do this. We applaud prosecutors to do when they do this. And when we do that, every time we do that, we make a Mike Nifong not only possible, but inevitable.
Kevin Durant, the University of Texas basketball player regarded as either the best or next best pro prospect, announced this week that he will enter the 2007 NBA draft. Would he be enough to resuscitate the Celtics, Grizzlies, Bucks, Sonics, Hawks, Blazers, or Bobcats?
He would be enough to resuscitate a few of them. It's going to be very interesting down the line if Greg Oden decides to stay at Ohio State. I don't think he will. I think he's going to come out, and I think he will be the first pick in the draft. But if he's not, it's Kevin Durant and a crapshoot. Because Kevin Durant will score 20 points a game his first year in the NBA. Whether that will be enough to resuscitate any of the franchises that you name, who can say? But he will be the first pick in the draft until Greg Oden makes up his mind.
The NHL playoffs started with a bang. Vancouver,
Is it still going on?
Months. Vancouver defeated Dallas in four overtimes on Wednesday night. Four, count them, four. The Sharks won in only two overtimes. Too bad nobody can see these games.
It's remarkable. I watched a couple of the games. Two of the overtimes. And I watched the games the other night when the Rangers got their first playoff win in an awfully long time. They're on the Versus Network, which is the formerly the Outdoor Life channel. The hockey camera work is, shall we say, rudimentary at best. And I think when you count up all the things the NHL has done wrong in the last 20 years, spurning ESPN a while back, which really loved the NHL and did a great job televising it in favor of whatever it was they spurned it for, is going to go down in history, along with wiping out an entire season as the worst decision they ever made.
Fans here in New England can take some solace in the fact that they didn't have the worst weather during baseball's opening week. That distinction would go to the Cleveland Indians.
Cleveland, the weather was so bad in Cleveland, they had to go to Milwaukee. Go figure that. And it snowed there, too, but the roof was closed.
Didn't matter. They played indoors.
So they got to play, you know, Major League Baseball, do better at the beginning of the year. There's no reason for Tampa to open the season on the road, none at all. You know, if you're going to play baseball in the upper latitudes in April and November, you're going to have moments like this.
And finally, Charlie, Peru's loss to Japan in a friendly soccer match last month did not seem to dismay Julio Uribe. He's Peru's coach. He went dancing after the 2-0 defeat, and I bet he wishes he hadn't done so.
You can tell by the way he used his walk, he's a woman's man, no time to talk. Yeah, he went to a disco and apparently got down and boogied in such a way that the Peruvian national soccer panjandrums decided he was inappropriately sad. Uribe, next time, throw yourself in the river.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time here on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks for listening to Only a Game. Please check your local listings for the NPR station nearest you to carry our show, and please visit our website, onlyagame.org.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new 240-horsepower turbocharged Acura RDX. More at Acura.com/RDX.